woke me up. What if Sister Mary Joseph Brays could intercede and free Gauche? My father would never come, but what if my birth mother was just waiting to be asked? I hoped she wouldn't hold my long absence from her desk chair against me. Seated, staring up at that print of the ecstasy of Saint Teresa, seeing only faint outlines as I hadn't put on the light, I felt as if I were in a confessional, but with no desire to confess. I was silent for 10 minutes or so. "You know, for the longest time I assumed that all babies came in twos," I said. I was making conversation. I didn't want to get to Gauche or the favor I sought right away. "Cthulhu's pups came in fours and sixes. At Mulu Farm, we saw a sow with twice that number. We are identical twins, but the truth is we aren't exactly identical. No, not the way a one burn note is identical with another burn note in all but the serial number. Shiva is actually my mirror image. I'm right-handed and Shiva's left-handed. The swirl on the back of my head is on my left, Shiva's is on the right." My hand went to my nose, again something I wasn't telling her. A month before the coup, I had a confrontation with Walid, who'd been teasing me over my name, such an easy target. I found myself flattened by a headbutt, a testa, and the fight went out of me. Testa, Italian for head, some claim is an ancient Ethiopian martial art, but if so, there are no dojos, no belts, just lots of broken noses. The only defense against a big knuckle is to lower your head. Walid used his testa when I wasn't expecting it. To my surprise, Shiva helped me up. Shiva was so tuned to the distress of animals and pregnant women, yet you could be blissfully unaware of the pain of other humans, especially if he was the cause. I watched in astonishment as Shiva confronted Walid. Walid's answer was another testa. Their frontal bones met with a sickening clash. When I could bear to look, I saw Shiva standing as if nothing had happened. The junior boys came running like vultures around carrion because the fall of a bully makes big news. Walid was supine on the ground. He came to his feet and tried it again. The dull thud of their heads left me in mortal fear for Shiva. But Shiva hardly blinked while Walid was out cold with a big gash on his skull. When he eventually returned to school, he was a subdued figure. That night, Shiva allowed me to explore his head. Unlike me, he had a gentle peak at the vertex, and his frontal bones were very thick and as hard as steel. My topography was different. I had asked Gauche why this might be, and he postulated that the instruments used on Shiva at birth might have caused the bones of his head to heal in this exuberant manner. Or else it might have had to do with the fact that we were conjoined. I was too proud to ask what exactly that meant. A folio-sized book in the British Council Library had pictures of Chang and Eng of Siam, the most famous Siamese twins. A few pages later was a portrait of the Indian Lalu, who toured the world as a circus freak. Lalu had a parasitic twin emerging from his chest. Lalu stood in a loincloth, and from his bare chest sprouted two buttocks and a pair of legs. To me, it looked as if the parasitic twin wasn't emerging from Lalu, but climbing back into him. When I could unglue my eyes from the pictures, every word in that text was a revelation to me. I learned that when two embryos just happened to grow in the mother at the same time, the result was fraternal twins. They didn't look alike, and they could be boy and girl. But if a single embryo in a mother happened to split very early on in its growth into two separate halves, the result was identical twins like me and Shiva. Conjoined twins, then, were identical twins, where the early split of the fertilized egg into two halves was incomplete, so the two halves remained stuck to each other. The result could be like Chang and Eng, two individuals connected at the belly or some other spot. It could also result in unequal parts, like Lalu and his parasitic twin. Did you know that Shiva and I were craniophagous? Connected at the head? I said to Sister Mary Joseph Praise. They cut that connection at birth. They had to. It was bleeding. I was silent for a long while, and I hoped she understood that I was being respectful. It was selfish for me to talk about our births when they coincided with her death. We had another long and awkward silence. Can you please get Ghosh out of jail? There, I said it. I waited for a reply. In the ensuing quiet, I felt guilt and shame wash over me. I hadn't told her that I ripped out the page on Lalu and left the library with it. I'd said nothing about killing the army man and how I feared a terrible retribution someday. There was something else I'd held back, something I understood only after seeing the pictures of Chang and Eng and of Lalu. The fleshy tube between Shiva and me had been cut and it was long gone. But it wasn't gone. It still connected us. That picture of Lalu captured how I felt, as if pieces of me were still stuck to Shiva and parts of him were inside me. I was connected to Shiva for better or worse. The tube was still there. What would it have been like if Shiva Marion walked around with heads fused? Or, imagine this, sharing one trunk with two necks? Would I have wanted to make my way, our way, through the world in that fashion? Or would I have wanted doctors to try and separate us at all costs? But no one had given us that choice. They'd separated us, sliced through the stalk that made us one. Who's to say that Shiva's being so different, his circumscribed, self-contained inner world that asked nothing of others, didn't come from that separation? Or that my restlessness, my sense of being incomplete, didn't originate at that moment? And in the end, we were still one, bound to each other whether we liked it or not. I left the autoclave room abruptly, without even a goodbye. How could I expect Sister to help me when I was holding back so much? I didn't deserve her intercession. So I was astonished when, an hour later, it came. It took the form of a cryptic note on a Russian hospital prescription pad. It came to Gibru from Tishome, his counterpart at the Russian hospital gates. Tishome said it was from a Russian doctor who had made Tishome swear to keep his identity a secret. On one side, the doctor had scribbled, "Ghosh is fine, absolutely no danger." On the back, Ghosh had scrawled, "Boys, screw your courage to the sticking place. Thank Almaz and no need to wait. Matron, please call in all favors. Hope lovely bride renews yearly contract. XXXG." I went back to the autoclave room. I stood behind the chair like a penitent, and I thanked Sister Mary Joseph Praise. I told her all. I held back nothing. I asked for her forgiveness, and for her to continue to help us free Ghosh. I saw Almaz anew. Saw her quiet strength and determination in the nightly vigil she had held outside Kachele prison. Whatever she lacked in education, she made up for in character and in loyalty. But I'd lost all respect for the Emperor. Even Almaz, always a staunch royalist, had a crisis of faith. No one really believed that Ghosh was a party to the coup. The problem was, and it was the same for hundreds of others who'd been rounded up, His Majesty Haile Selassie made all the decisions. His Majesty wouldn't delegate, and His Majesty felt no haste. Every afternoon, we went to Kachele to deliver the one meal we were allowed to bring, and to pick up the container bearing the previous day's meal. The relatives outside the prison were our family now. It was also the most fertile place to gather new information and plausible rumors. We heard that the Emperor took a morning walk in the palace garden, during which the Minister of Security, the Minister of State, and the Minister of the Pen came out to him one by one. They walked 3 paces behind him and reported on rumors and real events of the previous 24 hours. Each man worried whether the one who went before him had set a trap by mentioning something which he then failed to mention. Lulu, a royal diviner, peed on certain people's shoes, and the rumor mills were undecided if that was an indication that you were to be trusted or you were under suspicion. This was the sort of thing one learned by visiting Kochele. The next day, just 24 hours after my visit to Sister Mary Joseph Bray's, we were allowed to see Gosh. The prison yard, with its lawn and giant shade trees, looked like a picnic spot. Under that green canopy, the prisoners stood like leafless saplings. I spotted Gosh at once. Shiva and I flung ourselves into his arms. It didn't register till we were in his embrace that his head had been shaved or that his face had become gaunt. What did register was that my chest stopped aching for the first time in over a month. The scent on his clothes, on his person, was a coarse communal odor that made me sad because it spoke of his degradation. We stood aside to allow Hema and Matron to get near him, but I kept a hand on him, frightened that he might vanish. Some men were improved by losing weight, but Gosh, without his plump cheeks and jowls, looked diminished. Almaz stood back, her face all but hidden by the tail of her shama, waiting. Gosh freed himself from Hema and Matron, and he walked over to her. She bowed deeply, then bent as if to touch his feet, but Gosh grabbed her arms before she could, and he pulled her up and kissed her hands. He embraced her. He said he'd been so happy to see her standing and waving when they would take him back and forth in the covered jeeps, even though he knew she didn't see him. Almaz, whose teeth I'd never noticed before, grinned from ear to ear while tears ran down her face. "The only suffering for me was worrying about all of you. You see, I didn't know if they'd arrested Hema as well. Or maybe even Matron. When I saw Almaz standing in the prison yard, holding that picture of the family in her hands in that frame, I understood she was saying you were all right. Almaz, you put my heart at ease." None of us knew till then that Almaz's vigil had included the family picture, and that whenever a car came or left the prison, she'd stand up and hold that picture up and smile. The minutes were ticking by, and we pressed Gosh to tell us all. I don't think he wanted to alarm us, but he couldn't lie. "The first night was the worst. I was put in that cage," he said, pointing to a grubby, low-slung shack that looked like a storeroom. "It's a tiny space. You can't stand up. That's where they put common criminals, murderers, along with vagrant boys, pickpockets. The air is terrible, and at night they lock the door and then there's no air at all. This one fellow, a brute, rules the place, and he decides who sleeps where. The only place where you can get a little air is by the door, and in return for my wristwatch, he let me sleep there. If I spent another night there, I thought I'd have died. No sheets, no blankets, sleeping on the cold ground. When the sun rose, I was scratching from lice. A major came directly from the palace with instructions to take me to the military hospital and give me everything I needed to care for General Mebratu. The emperor didn't have much faith in the doctors who were caring for him. When this major saw where I'd spent the night and saw that my face was swollen and that I was limping, he was furious. He took me to the military hospital where I could shower, get deloused, and get a fresh set of clothes. At the military hospital, they showed me the general's x-rays, then took me to him. Who do I see there but Slava? Dr. Yaroslav from the Russian hospital. Slava was shaking badly and not looking good. As for Mebratu, he was in deep sleep, or else he was unconscious. Slava said the Ethiopian doctors wouldn't go near the general. They were terrified that if he died, they'd suffer. And if they saved him, they'd be suspected of being sympathizers. Slava, I said, tell me he is sedated, and wasn't this way before you saw him. Slava said the general had been wide awake, speaking, no weakness in his hands and legs when he came in. I was against sedation, Slava said. All this time, there was another Russian doctor with Slava, a youngish woman, Dr. Yekaterina. She said, sedation is very good. He has head injury. We have to operate. I said, head injuries are only important because the head contains the brain. That bullet is not near the brain. What do you call this? She says, pointing to his eye. Comrade, I said to her, I call it his orbit. She didn't think much of me, and I didn't like the way she was disrespectful of Slava. Slava may be an alcoholic, but he was a pioneer in orthopedics before they banished him to Ethiopia. Slava mouths to me from behind her, KGB. I called in the major. What are your instructions as far as my authority? He said, whatever you need, you are in charge. Those are my direct orders from His Majesty. Good, I said. Take this doctor back to Balcha Hospital. Don't let her come back. I need medical brandy, some smelling salts, and let's put 2 beds in this room for me and Slava. I dosed General Mebratu with every antibiotic there was and gave Slava the brandy, and he stopped shaking. Then Slava and I debrided the general's eye, right at the bedside, cut away what was hanging without trying to do too much more. The general never stirred. I had no plans to take the bullet out. For the next 2 nights, I had Slava for company, and I slept in a regular bed. It was 3 days before that communist sedation wore off. Slava, was that dose of sedative for a horse by any chance? I asked. No, but it was given by a nag named Yekaterina, Slava said. When General Mebratu woke up, other than a slight headache and a nasal voice, he was in good shape. They wouldn't let me stay there anymore, and they sent Slava off. That's when I scribbled the note. When I came back here, they put me in one of the proper cells with some decent chaps. They brought me back and forth once or twice a day to dress the wound, but I wasn't allowed more than a few words with the general. I'd already spotted 2 giant rats emerging in broad daylight from a gutter between 2 buildings. Ghosh was hiding things from us. But then we were hiding something from him. From that day on, we were allowed 2 weekly visits. Now the only question was when he would be released. First one, then another of Ghosh's VIP patients came by the house to pick up some comfort from home that Ghosh sought. A particular pen, more books, a paper in a certain stack. They'd bring with them a Latinate script in Ghosh's handwriting, a prescription for a compound mixture, and I'd lead them to Adam, the compounder. In Ghosh's absence, I understood what kind of doctor he was. These royals, or ministers, or diplomats, weren't seriously ill, not to my eyes anyway. They didn't have the power to get him out of jail, but they had the power to get into prison to see Ghosh. He, by pulling down the lower eyelid and looking at the color of the conjunctivae, by asking them to protrude the tongue, and all the while with his finger on the pulse, managed to diagnose and reassure them. The modern designation family practitioner doesn't quite cover all the things he was. 3 weeks after we first saw Ghosh, General Mebratu was put on trial, a show for international observers. An underground newspaper carried reports of the trial, as did a few foreign papers. General Mebratu, proud and far from penitent, wouldn't renounce what he'd done. His bearing made a great impression on people who were allowed to attend. From the witness box, he preached his message, land reform, political reform, and the end of entitlements that reduced peasants to slaves. Those who had fought to put down Mebratu's coup now wondered why they had opposed him. We heard that a corps of junior officers plotted to spring the general from prison, but Mebratu vetoed this. The death of his troops weighed on him. The court sentenced him to hang. His last words in the courtroom were, "I go to tell others the seed we planted has taken root." On the evening of the 49th day of Ghosh's captivity, a taxi drove up our driveway and swung around the back. I heard Almaz yell, and I tried to imagine what new calamity we were facing. Getting out of the taxi, surveying our quarters as if he'd never seen them before, was our Ghosh. Gibru, who'd ridden on the running board of the taxi from the gate, jumped off, clapping with glee, hopping in place. Genet and Rosina came out from their quarters. We danced around Ghosh. The air was filled with shrieks and with lululululu, the sound of Almaz's joy. Cuchulu was there, barking, wagging her tail and howling, the two nameless dogs standing at a distance following her cue. It was midnight when we went to bed, Shiva and me crowded in with Ghosh and Hema. It was far from comfortable, and yet I never slept better. I woke once and heard the sound of Ghosh's heavy snoring. It was the most reassuring sound on earth. We awoke early the next morning, our mood still celebratory. Unbeknownst to us, at that moment, General Mebratu, veteran of Korea and the Congo, graduate of Sandhurst and Fort Leavenworth, was taken to his execution. They hung him in a clearing in the Makato, perhaps because it was in the Makato that the student procession and the idea of the coup had found its most vocal support. The executioner, we later learned, was the emperor's aide-de-camp, a man General Mebratu had known for years. "If you ever love the soldier, put that knot carefully," General Mebratu was reported to have said. When the noose was in position, and just as the truck was about to pull away, the general took a running jump off the back of the truck, sailing off into martyrdom. We heard about it by late morning. That night, in the stone villas, the barracks and in chicker houses, junior officers who graduated from the Holetta Military Academy, or the Herer Military Academy, or the Air Force Academy in Debre Zeit, went to bed plotting to finish what General Mebratu had started. With every passing day, General Mebratu's stature grew until he was unofficially canonized. His likeness appeared in anonymous leaflets, drawn in the cartoon style of the ancient Ethiopic icon painters, with an abundance of yellow, green, and red. They depicted a black Christ, flanked by a black John the Baptist, and our own General Mebratu. All three had yellow halos around their heads and the River Jordan running over their feet. The text read, "For this is he that was spoken of by the prophet Isaiah, saying, 'The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make his path straight.'" Chapter 29. Abu Qasim's Slippers. 2 days after the general's execution, the hospital staff, led by Adam and W.W. Gonad, had a welcome back party for Ghosh. They bought a cow, hired a tent, and a cook. Adam slit the beast's throat. An overeager orderly with a yearning for gored gored, raw beef, cut a thin and still quivering steak from the flank while the animal stood on glass legs. They strung the cow from a tree, made their cuts, and carried the meat to an outdoor table to be processed. When I saw an army jeep come up our driveway, my blood turned cold. The cook stood still as we watched a uniformed officer go into our bungalow. I sleepwalked toward the house. I was at the front door when the officer stepped out, Ghosh and Hema with him. Shiva was by my side. "Boys," Ghosh said, "the motorcycle. Do you know who came to take it?
Ghosh was calm, unaware of any reason to be alarmed. My first response was relief. They hadn't come for Ghosh. Then, when it sunk in why the man was here, came panic. The five of us had worked out the story. A soldier came with the key, he drove the motorcycle away. We had no words with him. We'd repeated the story to Hema the day the soldier went missing. As preoccupied as she was with Ghosh's arrest, she'd shrugged it off. I was about to speak when I got a good look at the officer's face. It was the intruder, the army man, the one who came to take the motorcycle. It was his face, the same forehead and teeth, but a body that was not as lean and gangly. The spotless pressed uniform, the beret tucked under his shoulder lapel, gave him the manner of a professional soldier, something which the intruder had lacked. I felt my face turning colors. Rosina and Gennet came walking rapidly around the corner of the house. Word had gotten out. There was a crowd around us.
A soldier came with a key and he drove it away, Shiva said.
I nodded.
Yes.
The officer smiled. He leaned forward to me and said politely, in English,
Is there anything else you remember? Something you aren't telling me?
Ghosh interrupted, saying,
Ah, here's Rosina.
In Amharic, Ghosh said,
Rosina, this officer wants to know about Zumui's motorcycle.
Rosina made a deep bow. I was reminded of her politeness to the thief, and how her choice of words then had been inflammatory. I hoped she'd be prudent.
Yes, sir. I was with the boys when he came.
She stopped and brought the edge of a shama to her mouth, her eyes popping.
Excuse me, sir, the man... He looked very much like you. When I saw your face, forgive me.
And she made a little bow again.
He wasn't as polite as you. Dressed not like you.
We have the same mother, the officer said with a wry smile. It's true. He looks like me. What was he wearing?
Just the army jacket, no shirt. A white singlet underneath. Boots, trousers,
Rosina said.
Did he look all right to you?
He had his gun tucked here,
she said, pointing to a midriff,
instead of in his...
Holster,
the brother offered.
Yes, and he looked... His eyes red. He looked as if he might be...
Drunk, the brother said softly.
Did you ask him why he wanted the motorcycle?
Please, sir, he had that gun, she said. He seemed very angry. He had the key.
What did he say to you?
He said many things. He said he's taking the motorcycle. I said nothing.
She departed from the script we had rehearsed, but it seemed to be working.
Why? What has happened? What happened to the motorcycle?
Shiva said in English, his deadpan expression revealing nothing. I was astonished at Shiva's nerve.
Well, that's what I don't know, the officer said.
His English was excellent and his manner softened.
He wasn't supposed to take the motorcycle. The army wouldn't have let him keep it anyway.
He paused as if considering whether to say more. When he continued, it was to Ghosh and Hema that he directed his remarks.
He hasn't been seen since he came here. I'm posted in Dire Dawa, and I only found out he was AWOL 2 weeks ago. He told the woman he kept that he was going to pick up a motorcycle.
He turned to me and Shiva.
So you saw him drive away?
I heard the sound, I said.
He nodded.
Doctor, do you mind if I take a quick look around?
By all means, Ghosh said.
I felt the sky pressing down on me as the officer and his driver went to the back of the house and then walked down the gravel driveway. Had we come this far? With Ghosh free, only to have the army man send us back to hell? Gennet glared at me, while Rosina squatted, applying a eucalyptus stick to her teeth. The two men walked to the ledge, then turned in the direction of the roundabout and disappeared from view. If, on their return, they went to the tool shed, we were doomed. The motorcycle was well hidden, but not to one who was intent on finding it. After an eternity, they returned. "Thank you, Doctor," the officer said, extending his hand to Ghosh. "I fear the worst. The day the Emperor returned, some of our soldiers got their hands on a lot of money. My brother had something to do with that. It's perhaps a good thing he disappeared." Once the jeep was out of sight, Ghosh studied us for a moment. He sensed something amiss, but he didn't ask any questions. When Hema and Ghosh stepped back inside, I went to the corner of the house and I threw up. Gennet and Shiva followed me. I waved them off. The gastrointestinal system has its own brain, its own conscience. Inside the tent, the folding chairs wobbled on the soft grass. Soon, the table sagged with beakers of tej and plates of food. The kitfo, coarsely ground meat mixed with kibbe, a spiced and clarified butter, was my favorite dish. We never served this at home, but from the time I was a baby, I'd eaten kitfo in Rosina's quarters or in Gibru's shack. On this day, I had no appetite. The injera was stacked on the table like napkins. The gorid gorid was the dish everyone went after. Cubes of raw meat, which you dipped in a fiery red pepper sauce. The dishes kept coming. Meatballs, meat curry, lentil curry, tongue and kidney. What had been grazing under a tree that morning had, in short order, reached the table. Ghosh sat on a dais in an armchair. One by one, the nurses, nursing students, and other missing employees came to shake his hand and to praise the saints for allowing him to survive his ordeal. Rosina didn't come out, but I found Gennet in a corner of the tent. I sat by her. Dressed in black, pushing food around on her plate, she looked like a dour and distant cousin of the Gennet I knew. She'd hardly left the house since Zimui's death. When an orderly came and greeted her, kissed her on her cheeks, she barely acknowledged him. "When will you go back to school?" I said. "When will you start eating with us again?"
"They killed my father. Did you forget? I don't care about school."
Then she hissed at me.
"Tell the truth. You told Ghosh, didn't you?"
"I did not."
"But you were thinking of telling him, weren't you? Tell the truth."
She had me there. When I felt Ghosh's arms around me for the first time in that prison yard, a confession jumped to my lips. I had to suck it back and swallow.
"Since when did thinking become a crime? Don't look at me that way," I said.
She took her plate and sat far away from me. Even if I didn't have great faith in myself, I wanted her to have more faith in me. It hurt that she no longer saw me as the hero who shot the intruder. By the late afternoon, the tent came down, and now visitors from outside missing arrived as word spread that Ghosh was free. For Evangeline and Mrs. Reddy, the moment was bittersweet because, though Ghosh was back, General Mebratu was gone forever. Evangeline kept saying,
so young to be no more,"
dabbing at her eyes, while Mrs. Reddy comforted her, pulling Evangeline's head into her considerable bosom. The two brought a giant pot of chicken biryani and the fiery mango pickle that was Ghosh's favorite.
"It's your second honeymoon, sweetie,"
Evangeline said to Ghosh. She winked at Hema. Adid, their old friend, came carrying three live chickens roped together by their feet, handing them over to Almaz. He brushed feathers off his spotless white polyester shirt, which he wore over a flowing plaid ma'awis that extended to his sandals. Behind him came Babu, who was General Mebratu's usual bridge partner, bearing a bottle of Pinch, the general's favorite. By nightfall, there was talk of pulling out the cards for old time's sake. At any moment, I expected Zimui to drive up with General Mibratu. The house got stuffy. I opened windows back and front. At one point, Ghosh retreated to the bedroom to shed his sweater, and Hema went with him. I followed and stood in the doorway. He went to the bathroom to brush his teeth. It was as if he couldn't get over the novelty of running water. Hema stood outside the bathroom, looking at his reflection in the vanity.
"I've been thinking," I heard Ghosh say. "We've had a good innings. Maybe we should leave before the next coup."
"What? Back to India?"
Hema said.
"No. Then the boys would have to learn Hindi or Tamil as a compulsory second language. It's too late for that. Don't forget why we left in the first place."
They didn't know I was listening.
"Lots of Indian teachers have gone from here to Zambia," Hema said.
"Or America? To the county of Cook?" he said and laughed.
"Persia? They say there are huge needs, just like this place, but they have tons of money to spend."
Zambia? Persia? Were they joking? This was my country they were talking about, the land of my birth. True, its potential for violence and mayhem had been proved, but it was still home. How much worse would it be to be tortured in a land that wasn't your own? We've had a good innings. Ghosh's words felt like a kick to my solar plexus. This was my country, but I realized it wasn't Hema's or Ghosh's. They weren't born here. Was this for them a job only good for as long as it lasted? I slipped away. I stepped out to the lawn. I remember the air that night, and how it was so brisk that it could revive the dead. The fragrance of eucalyptus stoking a home fire, the smell of wet grass, of dung fuel, of tobacco, of swamp air, and the perfume of hundreds of roses. This was the scent of missing. No, it was the scent of a continent. Call me unwanted. Call my birth a disaster. Call me the bastard child of a disgraced nun and a disappeared father. Call me a cold-blooded killer who lies to the brother of the man I killed. But that loamy soil that nurtured matron's roses was in my flesh. I said Ethiopia like a native. Let those born in other lands speak of Ethiopia, as if it were a compound name like Sharm el-Sheikh, or Dar es Salaam, or Rio de Janeiro. The Entoto Mountains disappearing in darkness framed my horizon. If I left, those mountains would sink back to the ground, descend into nothingness. The mountains needed me to gaze at their tree-filled slopes, just as I needed them to be certain I was alive. The canopy of stars at night, that too was my birthright. A celestial gardener sowed mescal seeds so that when the rainy season ended, the daisies bloomed in welcome. Even the drowning soil, the foul-smelling quicksand behind missing, which had swallowed a horse, a dog, a man, and God knows what else. I claim that as well. Light and dark. The general and the emperor. Good and evil. All possibilities resided within me, and they required me to be here. If I left, what would be left of me? By 11 o'clock, Ghosh excused himself from the company in the living room and came back with us to our room. Hema followed. Shiva said, "We haven't slept in this bed since you left." Ghosh was touched. He lay in the center, and we huddled on either side. Hema sat at the foot of our bed.
"In prison, lights were out by 8 o'clock. We'd each tell a story. That was our entertainment. I told stories from the books we read to you in this room.
One of my cellmates, a merchant, Tofik, he would tell the Abu Qasim story. It was a tale well known to children all over Africa. Abu Qasim, a miserly Baghdad merchant, had held on to his battered, much-repaired pair of slippers, even though they were objects of derision. At last, even he couldn't stomach the sight of them. But his every attempt to get rid of his slippers ended in disaster. When he tossed them out of his window, they landed on the head of a pregnant woman who miscarried, and Abu Qasim was thrown in jail. When he dropped them in the canal, the slippers choked off the main drain and caused flooding, and off Abu Qasim went to jail.
One night, when Tofik finished, another prisoner, a quiet, dignified old man, said, "Abu Qasim might as well build a special room for his slippers. Why try to lose them? He'll never escape." The old man laughed. He seemed happy when he said that.
That night, the old man died in his sleep. The next night, out of respect for the old man, we lay in silence. No story. I could hear men crying in the dark. This was always the low point for me. Ah, boys. I'd pretend you both were against me, just like this, and I would imagine Hema's face before me. The following night, we couldn't wait to talk about Abu Qasim. We all saw it the same way. The old man was right. The slippers in the story mean that everything you see and do and touch, every seed you sow or don't sow, becomes part of your destiny. I met Hema in the septic ward at Government General Hospital in India, in Madras, and that brought me to this continent. Because of that, I got the biggest gift of my life, to be a father to you two. Because of that, I operated on General Mebratu, who became my friend. Because he was my friend, I went to prison. Because I was a doctor, I helped to save him, and they let me out. Because I saved him, they could hang him. You see what I am saying? I didn't, but he spoke with such passion I wasn't about to stop him. I never knew my father, and so I thought he was irrelevant to me. My sister felt his absence so strongly that it made her sour, and so no matter what she has or will ever have, it won't be enough. He sighed. I made up for his absence by hoarding knowledge, skill, seeking praise. What I finally understood in Kerchele is that neither my sister nor I realized that my father's absence is our slippers. In order to start to get rid of your slippers, you have to admit they are yours. And if you do, then they will get rid of themselves. All these years, and I hadn't known this about Ghosh, about his father dying when he was young. He was like us, fatherless, but at least we had him. Perhaps he'd been worse off than we were. Ghosh sighed. I hope one day you see this as clearly as I did in Kerchele. The key to your happiness is to own your slippers. Own who you are. Own how you look, own your family, own the talents you have, and own the ones you don't. If you keep saying your slippers aren't yours, then you'll die searching. You'll die bitter, always feeling you were promised more. Not only our actions, but also our omissions become our destiny. After Ghosh left, I wondered if the army man was my pair of slippers. If so, they'd come back once already in the form of his brother. What form would they take next? Just when my thoughts were coming in illogical sequences, a prelude to sleep, I felt someone lifting up the mosquito net. In the instant that I saw her, she was already sitting on my chest, pinning my arms down. I could have thrown her off, but I didn't. I liked her body on mine, and I liked the faint scent of charcoal and the frankincense that permeated her clothes. Maybe she'd come to make up to me for being so rude before. She could have climbed in through one of the open windows. In the light from the hallway, I could see the fixed smile on her face.
So, Marion, did you tell Gosh about the thief? If you were hiding here, you already know.
Shiva, awake now, looked at the two of us, then rolled over and closed his eyes.
You almost told that officer, his brother.
I didn't. I was just surprised, I said.
We think you told Gosh and Hema.
Of course not, I wouldn't.
Why wouldn't you?
You know why. If it gets out, they'll hang me.
No, they will hang me and my mother for sure. You'll be to blame.
I dream about his face.
I do too. And I kill him every night. I wish I'd shot him. It was an accident. If I'd killed him, I wouldn't call it an accident. If I'd killed him, we'd have no worries.
Easy for you to say because you didn't kill him.
My mother thinks you'll tell. We're worried about you.
What?
Well, you tell Rosina not to worry.
It'll slip out one day and get us all killed.
Okay, stop. If you know I'll tell, why talk to me? Get off me now.
She slid down so that her body was spread-eagled over mine. Her face hovered over me, and for one second I thought she was going to kiss me, which would have been very strange in the context of our exchange. I studied her eyes so close to mine, the blemish in the right iris, her breath on my face, sweet, pleasant. I could see the dangerous beauty she was going to turn into. I thought of the last time we were this close. In the pantry. Her pupils dilated, her eyelids sagged down over the irises. I felt something warm where her thighs were on top of mine, a spreading heat. I felt fluid soak my pajamas. The air under the mosquito net filled with the scent of fresh urine. Now her eyes rolled up, showing only the whites, and she threw her head back. She shivered. Her neck was arched, the strap muscles taut. She looked down one last time.
That's so you don't ever forget your promise.
She jumped off and was gone before I could think of reacting. I reared up now, ready to chase after her, to tear her to pieces. Shiva held me back. Whether from his desire to be a peacemaker or to protect her, I couldn't say. His eyes were downcast, and they managed not to look at me. I stood, shaking with anger, as Shiva stripped the bed. My pajama bottom was soaked. Shiva had been spared. In the bathroom, Shiva ran the tub, and I got in. Shiva sat on the commode, quiet, but keeping me company. We did not exchange a word. Back in the bedroom, I was putting on fresh pajamas when Gosh came in.
I saw your light. What happened?
An accident, I said. Shiva said nothing. The scent was unmistakable. I was ashamed. I could have told on Gennett, but I didn't. I opened the window for a few minutes and then closed it. Gosh wiped down the mattress. He helped us flip it over. He brought fresh sheets, made the bed for us. I could tell that he was distressed.
Go back to the guests, I said. We're all right, really.
My boys, he said, sitting on the edge of the mattress.
I know he thought I had wet the bed. I can't imagine what you have been through.
That was true. He couldn't imagine. And we probably wouldn't know what he'd been through either.
He sighed.
I'll never leave you again.
I felt a twinge in my chest at those words, a desire to make him take them back. He'd spoken as if it were all in his hands to decide, as if he had forgotten about fate and slippers.
Chapter 30. Word for Words. 60 days had passed since Zamui's death, and Genet was still confined to the house. Rosina, sinister with her missing tooth, was unsmiling and prickly, like an Abyssinian boar.
"Enough," Gebru told her on the Feast of St. Gabriel. "I'll melt a cross to get you a silver tooth. It's time to smile and to find white in your clothing. God wishes it. You are making his world gloomy. Even Zamui's legal wife has given up mourning."
"You call that harlot his wife?"
she screamed at Gebru.
"That woman's legs swing open when a breeze comes through the door. Don't talk to me about her."
The next day, Rosina boiled up a big basin of black dye, and into this she tossed all her remaining clothes, as well as a good many of Genet's school clothes. When Hema tried to get Genet to go back to LTNC, Rosina rebuffed her.
"She's still in mourning."
2 days later, on a Saturday, I heard a lululu of celebration from Rosina's quarters as I was coming into the kitchen. I knocked. Rosina opened it just a crack, peering out at me with a hunter's eye, a blade in her hand.
"Is everything all right?"
"Fine, thank you,"
she said, and closed the door, but not before I saw Genet, a towel pressed to her face, and bloody rags on the floor. I couldn't keep this knowledge to myself. I told Hema, and now she knocked on the door. Rosina hesitated.
"Come in if you must,"
she said, her manner surly.
"We are all done."
The room was redolent of cloistered women, and frankincense and something else. The scent of fresh blood. It was difficult to breathe. The naked bulb hanging from the ceiling was off.
"Close the door,"
Rosina snapped at me.
"Leave it open, Marion,"
Hema said,
"and turn on the light."
A razor blade, a spirit lamp, and a bloody cloth were by Genet's bed. Genet sat demure, her hands pressed to both sides of her face, her elbows resting on her knees. The posture of a thinker, but for the rags in each hand. Hema pulled Genet's fingers away to reveal 2 deep vertical cuts, like the number 11, just past the outer end of each eyebrow. A total of 4 cuts. The blood that welled up looked as dark as tar.
"Who did this?"
Hema said, covering the wound and applying pressure. The 2 occupants were silent. Rosina's eyes were locked on the far wall, a smirk on her face.
"I said, who did this?"
Hema's voice was sharper than the razor that made the cuts. Genet replied in English.
"I wanted her to do it, Ma."
Rosina said something sharp to Genet in Tigrinya. I knew that short guttural phrase meant shut your mouth. Genet ignored her.
"This is the sign of my people," she went on. "My father's tribe. If my father were alive, he would have been so proud."
Hema opened her mouth as if considering what to say. Her face softened a bit.
"Your father isn't alive, child. By the grace of God, you are."
Rosina frowned, not liking this much of an exchange in English.
"Come with me. Let me take care of that,"
Hema said more gently. I knelt beside Genet.
"Come with us, please."
Genet glanced nervously at her mother, then hissed.
"You'll only make it harder for me. I wanted these marks as much as she did. Please, please go."
Ghosh counseled patience. "She isn't our daughter."
"You're wrong, Ghosh. She ate at our table. We sent her to school at our expense. When something bad is happening to her, we can't say she isn't our daughter."
I was stunned to hear what Hema said. It was noble. But if Hema saw Genet as my sister, this introduced complications as far as my feelings for Genet. Ghosh said soothingly,
"It's just to keep away the Buddha, the evil eye.
like the pottu on the forehead in India, darling. My pottu comes off, darling. No blood is shed.
A week later, when Hema and Ghosh came home from work, they heard Rosina's wailing soliloquy, loud as ever, no different than when they'd left for work that morning. She bemoaned fate, God, the Emperor, and chastised Zemui for leaving her.
That's it, Hema said. The poor child will go mad. Are we going to stand by while that happens?
Hema gathered Almaz, Gibru, WW, Ghosh, Shiva, and me. En masse, we went to Rosina's door and pushed it open. Hema grabbed Genet by the arm and brought her into our house, leaving the rest of us to pacify Rosina, who screamed to the world that her daughter was being abducted. Behind the closed door of Hema's bedroom, we could hear the sounds of Genet in the tub. Hema came out to get milk and asked Almaz to slice up papaya and pour lemon and sugar over it. Soon Almaz disappeared into the bedroom and stayed there. An hour later, Hema and Genet emerged arm in arm. Genet was in a sequined yellow blouse and a glittering green skirt, parts of Hema's Bharatanatyam dance outfit. Her hair was pulled back off her forehead, and Hema had darkened her eyes with a kohl pencil. Genet stood regal, happy, her head high, her carriage that of a queen who'd been unshackled and restored to her throne. She was my queen, the one I wanted by my side. I was so proud, so drawn to her. How could she ever be my sister when she was already something else to me? Hema's glittering green sari matched Genet's colors. We almost missed the sight of Almaz ducking away to the kitchen, her eyes darkened, her lips red, blush on her cheeks, and huge dangling earrings framing that strong face. The five of us piled into the car, Genet in the back seat between me and Shiva. At the Mercato, Hema got a new set of clothes for Genet. It was Christmas and Diwali and Mezcal all rolled into one. We finished up at Enrico's. Genet sat across from me, smiling at me as she licked her ice cream. Hesitantly at first, but then gathering speed, she chattered away. If she'd been brainwashed, as Hema said, her brain was drying out. I picked my moment, having scouted the obstacles under the table. I loved her so much. But I hadn't forgotten the indignity of her visit to my bed not 2 weeks before, and the wet present she left me. I loved the image of her hovering over me, a moment of such rare beauty, but I wanted to erase the wet part. I kicked her shin savagely with my toe cap. She managed not to make a sound, but the pain showed in her face and in the tears that sprung to her eyes. "What's the matter?" Ghost said. She managed to say,
"I ate my ice cream too fast."
"Ah, ice cream headache. Strange phenomenon. You know, that is something we ought to study, don't you think, Hema? Is it a migraine equivalent? Is everyone susceptible? What is its average duration? Are there complications?"
"Darling," Hema said, kissing him on the cheek, such a rare display of affection in a public place. "Of all the things you've wanted to study, you finally found one I'd love to study with you. I'm assuming it will involve lots of ice cream?" In the car, Genet showed me the big welt on her shin.
"Are you done?" she said quietly. "No, that was just a warm-up. I have to repay you in kind." "You'll ruin my new clothes," she said coyly, leaning against me.
The scars at the ends of both eyebrows were still angry at the edges. Hema saw them as barbaric, but I thought they looked beautiful. I put my arm around Genet. Shiva looked on, curious as to what I would do next. Those slashes next to her eyes made her look preternaturally wise, because they were at the spot where people developed wrinkles when they aged. She grinned, and the number 11s were exaggerated. I felt my heart racing, powerless. Who was this beauty? Not my little sister. Not even my best friend. Sometimes my opponent. but always the love of my life.
So, she said again, seriously, are you done with your revenge?
I sighed. Yes, I'm done.